Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Rick is a highly credentialed patent attorney, but he's our historian, even more importantly. And today, we're going to talk about Tarawa. We'll find out what all that is. Rick Bigelow, welcome back. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Bob. How are you?
I'm excited. Whenever you are with us, I'm excited because I know I'm going to learn something. I'm going to be reminded of many other things, and that this historical context that is so important to this show will be fulfilled. So thank you. Always great to have you. Talk to me. Tell us about it.
Well, today we're going to talk about Tarawa in 1943. This, of course, is Thanksgiving week, and Thanksgiving week in 1943, 20 or 30,000 Marines, soldiers, sailors, Coast Guardsmen were getting ready to embark on the first part of Admiral Nimitz's island-hopping campaign at the Tarawa Atoll. A little bit of background on Tarawa. It's part of the Gilbert Islands. Gilbert Islands had been a British colony since 1892. The islands are about 2,500 miles southwest of Hawaii. So that means they're about 5,000 miles from the west coast and 8,000 miles from the east coast of the United States. So,
and by really the way, for listeners, if you can go to WILKNewsRadio.com, we have these maps on the, when you go to, you press watch, and we have the maps just so you can put it in geographical context.
Right, good. So it really is out in the middle of nowhere. And the Gilbert Islands are pretty much smack dab right on the equator. So you know it was going to be hot from sunup to sundown. Hmm. So Gilbert's had been a British colony since 1892. Japan took the Gilbert's on December 9th, 1941, a couple days after Pearl Harbor. They built an airstrip on Tarawa and built a seaplane base on Mackin Island, which is like 100 miles north of Tarawa. These Japanese air bases threatened the Allied supply routes from the west coast of the U.S. to Australia. So they became a real source of concern for the Allied command. In November 1943, Thanksgiving week, U.S. forces were ready to begin the Allied island hopping campaign across the Central Pacific in accordance with the war plans Orange and Rainbow Five. These war plans had been developed for the last 20 years, continuously updated, so on and so forth. So Tarawa itself is an atoll. It's, like I said, about 2,500 miles southwest of Honolulu. It consists of about
That's practically cross country. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. And 5,000 miles from the coast, that's almost the breadth of the United States twice.
Yeah.
These are
a round trip to Europe.
Remarkable. The scope of what had to be conquered and dealt with is awesome. When you mentioned we're going to have our beautiful Thanksgivings here, many of us fortunate enough to have a Norman Rockwell Thanksgiving with our families. And here were our boys at that time. Wow.
Yeah, and if they're lucky, they got some K rats or C rats or something like that for Thanksgiving. For the assault forces, they generally had steak and eggs the day of the assault, so it wasn't all that bad to start with. So the total area of the Tarawa Atoll is about 12 square miles. The key island is Betio Island, which is Betio. It's only about 2.5-3 miles long and 700 yards at its widest, and that's where the airstrip was. The other islands in the atoll were only minimally manned with Imperial Japanese Army troops. So the main characteristic of the island was the airstrip, which took about half of Betio Island. So, like I said, it's right on the equator. It's a tropical jungle type of situation. There isn't all that much shade, and there's very little fresh water. And it was scorching hot from sunup to sundown.
And Rick Bigelow, that's obviously a major factor in the logistics of this whole thing, is you've got to be pumping water to these troops constantly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, everybody went ashore with at least two canteens. And, a big part of the logistics exercise was bringing in fresh water and food for the troops and for the Marines. So the Japanese had fortified the southern part of Betio Island, figuring that the Americans couldn't attack the northern side because of the reefs that protected the northern side of the island. So the Japanese constructed pillboxes, concrete bunkers, coconut log stockades, and coconut log seawalls all along the southern part and along the northern part of Betio Island, too. So the Japanese had 14 tanks, 40 artillery pieces, 14 naval guns, and about 4,900 troops, and some 1,200 Korean slave laborers. We thought we'd take Tarawa in one day. We came in with the 5th Fleet, which was starting to get bigger these days. We had 17 aircraft carriers, 12 battleships, 12 cruisers, 66 destroyers, and about 12,000 Marines of the 2nd Marine Division were going to be the initial assault wave.
Rick Bigelow, so let's take 1943, November 1943. That's almost the height of American manufacturing and military development, right? I mean, we're really at our peak, pumping out ships and planes and munitions.
We are doing a lot. And the key was we could work 24/7 in our factories. And so we were really, really pumping out all the equipment and the ships and the airplanes that you needed. Of course, some of them were going to Europe. Some of them were going to England. And even a significant portion of all kinds of military equipment, and especially oil, was going to the Soviet Union. In fact, I think just about all their aviation gasoline came from the United States. So we truly were the arsenal of democracy at this point in time.
The other countries, enemy, friend, and foe alike, had to be saying, how are they doing this?
Yeah,
how is this possible?
That's exactly right. And I think one thing you got to give FDR a lot of credit for, you know, of course, his administration was full of new dealers who had a visceral disrespect for capitalism and for banks and manufacturing and industry and stuff like that. And initially they said, well, you know, American industry will produce war materials at cost. And FDR said, no, you got to let them make a profit, because if they make a profit, they'll turn it around and increase capacity and pay better wages and all that sort of stuff.
And make better product and develop new weapons and munitions. Yeah.
Correct. So you got to give FDR a lot of
credit. They're not bad for a guy who inherited his money to know that. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, talk about somebody who never really had a job in his life. I guess he worked at a Wall Street law firm for a little bit after Columbia Law School.
His time with the Department of Navy must have really been a formative period.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, even though he was the assistant secretary of the Navy, he ran the Navy Department.
Yeah.
Because the guy who was the secretary of the Navy, just he was a political employee. And he just specialized in going to Washington parties and all that. FDR really took an interest in the Navy. And when he was assistant secretary of the Navy, of course, this was in Wilson's administration. He became very close to a commander named Leahy, who eventually became his top aide and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in World War II. And, you know, people say Harry Hopkins was his closest confidant, but in reality, it was Admiral Leahy who was his. He was always in FDR's ear,
and his son,
FDR had a lot of respect.
His son, wasn't he Department of the Navy during the Reagan administration?
Admiral Leahy?
Yeah.
That was John Leahy. That was a different Leahy.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought they were
family.
Related.
No, I don't think so. But I thought Admiral Leahy just had a daughter.
Okay.
That was it. But, okay. You know, I'll check on that. That's an interesting question.
I assume generational things. But anyway, so let's get, because we got to, I want to take a break, but I want to hit the neap tide before we do.
So this is a phenomena in tidal work. A neap tide is a tide that occurs just after the first or third quarters of the moon, when there's the least difference between high and low water. And this is important because there was a reef surrounding the landing beaches at Tarawa, and we had to land at high water so that the landing craft could get over the reef. We had done all kinds of studies and we took counsel from New Zealand ship captains who had been running in and out of Tarawa for years and years about conditions of the reef and the inlet to the lagoon and all that sort of stuff. And it turned out that at the Tarawa landing, it occurred during a neap tide that coincided with the moon's closest position relative to the Earth, which accentuated the shallowness of the high tide. In other words, the high tide was not very high during this neap tide and closeness of the moon to the Earth. So aviators were flying over the island, and people on the ships were saying, "Is there water over the reef?" And the aviators said, "Nope, I can see the reef clear as day." So that was a real issue, which we'll talk about, because they had two different types of landing vehicles. One was the amphibious tractors, Amtraks. They could make it over the reef, but the landing craft couldn't. So that was a complication.
Amazing. I the logistics just amaze me on any of these assaults.
Absolutely.
How many of this do we need? Do we have them? Who's manufacturing them? All of those things are just remarkable. All right, Rick Bigelow is our guest. Tarawa Island and the conquest of same is our subject. November 20th, day one, is our next topic. We'll take a break and be back with Rick Bigelow.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here, wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium, unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day. Yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds slow after 35 gigabytes of networks busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
We're talking with our man, Rick Bigelow, and Tarawa, Macon Islands. He's with us talking about all of that. So the stage is set, Rick. Tarawa Atoll landings on Betio Island. Fire away.
Okay, so the way this was happening, the Allied ships would have to stay outside the lagoon. And that would be the transports and also the ships that were carrying all the Marines. So they would drop the Marines into the boats, into the landing craft. And they'd have to go in through the lagoon and then take a right turn and head due south and attack the northern end of Bashio Island. So for some of these guys, it was a 5 to 7 mile trip. From the transports and the amphibs into the beach. And for many of them, especially those who are in the second and subsequent waves, they were out there bouncing around in the landing craft and the Amtraks for a couple hours. In fact, some of them were there almost half a day bouncing around in the landing craft. So The initial attack was to attack the north side of Bashio Island and then proceed in to take the airfield. And of course, getting the airfield was the whole goal of the operation. So the 2nd Marine Division attacks Red Beach 1, 2, and 3 at about 9:30 on the first day of November 20th. They are immediately met with stern Japanese opposition. And what I wanted to say was they did 3 hours of naval bombardment. Of course, they had all kinds of battleships and cruisers and destroyers. And then they stopped after 3 hours, and then an air raid came in and strafed the airfield and strafed the Japanese positions. And then there was another 15 minutes or so of naval bombardment. And everybody figured, well, nobody could survive that. They must all be dead. There won't be anybody alive. Well, that was incorrect. The Japanese had learned to dig in. And unless a, you know, like a 14-inch battleship shell did a direct hit on a bunker or something like that, they could withstand the naval and the aerial bombardment. So
and these are not smart bombs. pretty dumb bombs. They're just firing and coming as close as they can.
Yeah, and you know they weren't bad, but you know if they hit the beach, they were pretty happy.
So
I mean they got better as the war progressed, but at this point in time, we were still learning. And, of course, you know, there was a significant Japanese fleet up in the Marshall Islands, which is about 700 miles north of the Gilberts. And the Japanese commander on Tarawa was expecting the Japanese fleet to sortie south and take on the American fleet. But for some reason, they did not do that. And after about a day, the Japanese commander was told, you guys are on your own.
Oh my God.
You know, what that presents is a very difficult problem for defending troops, because on an island like this, you can't retreat. You know, if you're on a big land campaign, there's always the possibility to retreat. Here, you're either going to be killed, wounded, or captured. And the way that the Japanese code went, that was the worst thing you could do is be captured. In fact, if you were captured, it brought dishonor on you, your family, and all your ancestors. So the Japanese were going to fight probably to the death, which is something we'd learned on Guadalcanal. And so the troops came ashore expecting light resistance. Some of the Amtraks and all of the landing craft got hung up on the reefs. And so the Marines had to wade ashore, often about 500 yards or so. And of course, the Japanese just picked them off, and you know, hundreds of Marines died on the way into the shore. So many of the Amtraks that made it to the shore couldn't make it past the seawall, which was a wall that we hadn't noticed in all our aerial photography, that was several feet high, and it was made of concrete and coconut logs. So that was another significant barrier. So there was tremendous fighting and a lot of dead and wounded Marines in the first several hours of the assault. Within a few hours, we held a narrow beachhead, and we fortified it and brought more Marines in subsequent waves. And of course, the Japanese counterattacked at night, and the counterattacks were beat back. So that was the date, the first day, which was November 20th. On November 21st, we landed some more Marines on the western side of Betchio Island at Green Beach. And between the Marines that were on Red Beach and the Marines on Green Beach, we expanded the beachhead. We started to push inland, and we headed towards the airstrip. The Japanese continued heavy resistance, and they had a bonsai charge at night. So we're making slow but steady progress. By day three, the Marines took the airstrip. The Japanese were experiencing tremendous casualties and fatalities. The Japanese were pushed to the eastern side of Betchio Island. They knew that they were just about spent. So at nighttime on the third day, there were three Japanese nighttime bonsai charges. They were repulsed by the Marines, Marine artillery, and also naval bombardment, because some of the destroyers actually came into the lagoon and were supporting the Marines with naval bombardment.
Rick, at the time of this engagement, to the extent you know, there had to be incredible respect, if not fear, on both sides, the Americans to the Japanese and how viciously they fought, but the Japanese to the Americans on how brutally they fought and how they were just unstoppable. The word had to be spreading.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. The Japanese were more afraid of the Marines than anybody. In fact,
the devil dogs.
The Japanese propaganda was that the only way to become a U.S. Marine was you had to kill your parents. and that just reinforced their...
I don't think that'd be too inspiring. That backfired.
So they would just as soon kill themselves than be killed by a Marine or taken prisoner by a Marine.
Yeah.
But there was, we were especially concerned with Japanese Marines who were called Special Naval Infantry, and there were a lot of them on Betchio Island, and the Japanese were concerned about the U.S. Marines, too. Mm. So we get to day four. The Marines repel a final bonsai charge. The Marines declare Betchio is secure and move on to the other islands in the atoll. Like I said, most of the other islands were only minimally manned by the Japanese at that point in time. So it was just an instance of mopping up.
I want to highlight this statistic of the 3,700 Japanese.
Right.
How many 17, were left? 17.
17 survived.
Oh, my
and
God.
They were typically wounded, who were too badly wounded to participate in the bonsai charge or something like that. They also had 1,200 Korean laborers, slave laborers on the island, and only 129 of them survived. And like I intimated, many Japanese soldiers killed themselves rather than submit to the dishonor of surrender. And the U.S. Casualties, 1,009 Marines were killed in action, 2,100 were wounded in action.
1,009 letters going out to parents in the United States.
That's right.
Thanksgiving
in fact,
week.
One Marine second lieutenant wrote a night before the invasion letter home. And in the letter, he said to his wife, the Marines teach you to be scared, not scared of war, not scared of dying, but scared of letting your fellow Marines down. Hmm. So that Marine was killed on Bexiou Island. So the aftermath, the American public was shocked by the carnage. Since this is the first invasion of a heavily defended island in the mid-Pacific, a lot of correspondents from the media went along, and they wrote their stories and called it as they saw it. In fact, many of the correspondents went ashore on the first day in one of the later waves. So the American public got a pretty good indication of what had happened. This battle told us that defeating the Japanese would not be easy. We also knew that we needed to get better tide and reef information. So they started forming the underwater demolition teams, who are the forerunner of the Navy SEALs. The issues with the Higgins boats, the landing craft, and the amphibious tractors had to be resolved. One of the issues with the Amtraks was in the first instance of the Amtraks, they weren't very heavily armored. And machine gun bullets would penetrate the armor. So they had to up-armor them. They had to make them put more guns on them and just make them more able to withstand counter-battery. Future assaults would include several days
and
Rick,
you make that sound simple, but they had to get the steel plating and they had to have the tools to rivet the steel plating onto these boats. And they had to make sure that it was all the proper balance and all that kind of thing. It wasn't easy to make the fixes that had to be made.
Yeah, in fact, you know, a lot of it was welding, which means you got to have the welding gases and
welders.
And then you had to make sure you didn't put so much weight in it that you couldn't put as many soldiers and equipment into it. Yeah. So there was just continual upgrading and testing all during World War II. And, you know, the final thing is future assaults would include several days of naval bombardment. In fact, by the time we got to Iwo Jima and Okinawa, it was like a month of naval bombardment before they went ashore. So the second part is the invasion of Mackinac Island, which was by the 27th Infantry Division, which had been a Hawaii National Guard Division that had been federalized. The Japanese only had about 800 troops on Mackinac. And of course, the reason we went after that was because there was a seaplane base on there. Mm-hmm. And the seaplanes were very valuable because they could go for 1,000 miles without needing to be refueled. So they were very valuable for scouting missions. So we had to take them out. Battle around Mackinac Island, one of the escort carriers was sunk by a Japanese submarine, killing 644 sailors. The Army lost 66 killed in action on Mackinac Island. The Japanese lost 400, and once again, very few POWs, and 250 Korean laborers were killed, and 130 were taken prisoner. And frankly, the Koreans were happy to be taken prisoner at this point in time. So we secured the Gilberts, and the next stop was the Marshall Islands.
And some of the same troops did it
right
after watching and participating in this absolute carnage on Tarawa and Mackin. Well, Tarawa in particular. Wow.
Right.
Oh, Lord, thank God for the Marines. Well, Rick Bigelow, thank you so much. It wakes me up every time I think about what these men went through and what they did and how great their achievement. We appreciate it.
Thanksgiving week.
Thanksgiving week. Well, happy Thanksgiving to you, Rick. I look forward to your next appearance.
Same to you, Bob.
All right, my man.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcasts.